Now, the world is messing with our minds. Rates of stress and anxiety are rising, and a fast and nervous planet is creating fast and nervous lives. We are more connected, no doubt about that, but why do we feel more alone? And we're encouraged to worry about so many things. There's a man now who I think worries about more than most things. It's Matt Haig, who's written a book called Notes on a Nervous Planet, and he joins us now. Morning, Matt.
Hello there, it's nice to be here, thank you.
Good to talk to you, sir. Now, you're an interesting chap because apart from writing this and, of course, your book Reasons to Stay Alive, you also write children's books as well.
Yeah, I do. I like to balance the two, actually. I like to, you know, talk about, honestly, about mental health and all that heavy stuff, and I like to balance it with escaping into worlds of pixies and elves. Actually, my latest kid's book is a bit of a hybrid because it's called The Truth Pixie, and it's a fantasy story, but it's also a mental health story for kids in a way. But obviously, with kids, you don't give them a heavy-duty self-help book, but it's just a story about self-acceptance, and it's going down really well in the UK, so that was a nice surprise. But yeah, I think there were, even though I write lots of different stuff, a lot of the sort of mental health stuff feeds into it anyway, because, you know, my view is almost everything is mental health in some sense. You know, we might not all have mental illness, but we've all got mental health, and we all, you know, it's how we think and how we feel and all of that.
Yes, it's interesting what you mentioned there about the kids' book, because the one you're mentioning there, the your latest book, you're quite honest, aren't you, to children? And I think that's a good thing, because children are sometimes cloaked and given rose-coloured spectacles, and when real things happen to them in the world, they're a bit surprised by it all.
Well, absolutely. So, you know, I had this idea of a character, the Truth Pixie, who could only tell them the truth. And I think, you know, often with kids, the temptation is to sugarcoat everything and sort of to hide a lot of realities in life. But obviously, kids' lives aren't always 100% perfect. Mm. You know, they're often, you know, they might lose a parent or a grandparent, or their parents might get divorced or they move house or whatever. You know, kids, like adults, have a lot of change in their lives, a lot of situations.
Yeah.
And so I thought it'd be nice to actually acknowledge that, but also say, you know what, yes, this is a hard time now, you're seven, but wait until you're eight, and this is going to happen, and that's going to happen. And you know, because that's the thing with adults and kids, I think, you know, well, certainly with me, when I was at my lowest points in life, you kind of lose that perspective and that understanding that actually this isn't permanent. You know, there is, you know, that old cliche about time healing and life moving on.
Yeah.
You know, there is a lot of truth in that.
You've just painted a picture of me. I mean, I basically, in my childhood, I'm not going to bang on about it, but, you know, divorced parents, dodgy childhood, moving all the time, people dying left, right and centre.
Yeah.
And I would say that made me stronger.
Yeah, well, I mean, absolutely. And I feel like, you know, resilience isn't about nothing bad ever happening to you. Resilience is about how you, you know, deal with that, how you respond to that. You know, happiness, we don't live in a perfect world of unicorns and rainbows. Happiness is about, you know, we can only ultimately, unfortunately, rely on ourselves for that sort of inner strength. And, you know, I often sort of get into debates about this with mental health, because obviously depression is a horrible thing, but I take a bit of dispute about the idea that mental illness is weakness, and the idea that healthy mental health is strength, because actually I was never stronger than at those lowest points.
Interesting.
Yes, I couldn't do a lot of things that, inverted commas, normal people could do, but when I was, you know, even, for instance, the most courageous thing I ever did, which sounds utterly ridiculous, was when I was in the midst of a breakdown and literally going outside on my own, walking about 500 meters to a corner shop, battling agoraphobia and all this weird stuff that I had no understanding of, but it was totally crippling me at that time. But that refusal to be beaten by it, by the sort of stuff that was going on in my head, you know, I've done obviously much more outwardly sort of braver, and, you know, I've survived hospital operations, done this, that, and the other, travelled all around the world, but still just going around the corner in the small town where my parents live, on my own, was still, that was the hardest thing I ever did. So there's this idea you know, it's basically what I'm saying is it's not what you do, it's what you battle to do what you do, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll talk in detail about the book in a moment, but a bit about yourself. I mean, you have suffered from various things in life, anxiety, panic attacks. It looks like quite a few of your panic attacks happened in Spain. I would suggest you avoid Spain at all costs.
Yes, has been suggested. Well, no, I lived a long time in Spain. We had 3 years being young, crazy people in Ibiza. And then lots of times in Barcelona and Seville. I love Spain. Spain's still one of my favourite places to go. But no, I did have a full-blown... One of my most recent panic attacks was in a tapas bar in Seville. But I don't think it was anything to do with being in Seville. I think it was the fact that I hadn't slept very well.
Right. Pleased to hear it. for those of us who are lucky enough to have not suffered anxiety or panic attacks, is it possible to describe, Matt, what it feels like to have a panic attack?
I tried my best. I mean, that's what I wanted to do. The first time I wrote about this in Reasons to Stay Alive, that's basically what I was trying to do. I was trying to make this invisible thing of, you know, mental illness, mental health conditions, and trying to make what I experienced visible, you know, through metaphor and stuff. But I think ultimately it is quite hard for people who haven't gone through it to understand this, because everyone thinks they've gone through moments of pain in their life and they've pulled themselves out of it. But I think there's a failure to understand that actually mental illness is illness. You know, when you cross a line, because I would have been someone who thought, I'm never going to fall apart. I'm this sort of person. Mm. And then something happens and you do. And there's no shame in that, because that's just, your brain is a physical thing, like your body's a physical thing. I think what people don't understand about something like a panic attack is how physical it is.
Right.
How much of it is sensation. You know, when I first had a panic attack, I didn't think it was anything to do with my thoughts. I thought something, you know, I thought either I was having a heart attack or I was having some kind of physical breakdown. But, you know, loads of the symptoms were sort of below the neck. You know, it was your heart racing, aching limbs, just a feeling of sort of like detachment, almost like an out-of-body experience. And it's not just to do with worries in your head, but I think that's what people don't quite understand. It's also sensations as well.
And I would imagine it's made all the worse by the fact you can't nail it onto something, so you can't say the reason I had that was because of this.
No, absolutely. And I think that's what I've learned over the years, because obviously when I was at my lowest point and I felt like I couldn't get out of it with depression and panic disorder, I was suicidal for a while. And the reason I was suicidal wasn't because I had a sudden death wish. It's just I thought, I literally can't cope with this pain forever. And because I had no idea of how I'd got into that mess, I had no idea of how to get out of it. And the thing that happens when you hold on, and when you don't do that, and you hold on, is you start to make connections. Yes, but with me, there wasn't one thing. There wasn't one trigger. No one had died. There wasn't one easy thing to say, oh, this is why I'm like this. But as with physical health, you slowly realize over time there are things you can do that make you feel a little bit better, things you can do that make you feel a bit worse. And it changes from person to person, but you build up that toolkit. And so it's not foolproof. I can still have dips of anxiety and depression now, but your means to recovery become a little bit quicker, a little bit simpler.
Now, I started there by saying that the world is messing with our minds. In the book, you talk about things like air pollution, takeaway pizzas, radiation, self-harming teenagers, carbon monoxide emissions, deforestation of the Amazon, a list of stuff that the world puts in front of us that makes us feel bad, to be honest. Yeah. But I guess in a way, Matt, that's always happened in life. You know, my gran would have said the same thing about television sets and you know, fast cars and all the rest of it. But I would also counter that by saying that now, with the advent of technology, it's made it much worse than it ever was. Would that be fair?
I think we experience it more. I feel like, you know, I mean, if you go back to like the Second World War, obviously people say, oh, well, we're not in a world war now, you know, what's everyone moaning about? But the difference is we see so much, you know, we've got camera phone footage of everything, you know, it might be irrational to have a fear of terrorism or whatever it is, but because we've got those images in our head, it's more visceral in a way. And I think we're overloaded. You know, ultimately, human beings, according to all the sort of scientists and evolutionary psychologists, human beings haven't physically evolved for about 30,000 years. Our minds and bodies were perfectly adapted to life 30,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. Now we're in a world that changes almost, you know, an incredible amount in the space of a decade. You know, if you think about how much our life has changed by technology in just 10 years, you know, we are not equipped for a lot of what we deal with in life. For instance, you know, our old sort of caveman ancestors, they were only ever going to sort of know at maximum about 150 new people in their lifetimes. Now you can encounter, if you're on Instagram or something, you can encounter 150 new faces and people in a single morning before breakfast. Mm. You know, we're overloaded all times, whether it's what radio station to listen to, what book to read, what TV show to watch. You know, we're in this world of infinite choice, and we're conditioned to believe choice is good, but there comes a point where it's almost paralyzing, and we feel that most, I think, in terms of news, you know, because we've bombarded with negative information, which, let's face it, that's what news is, negative information, from all sides all the time. Mm. And we end up not being able to do much about it, and that makes us anxious, I think, that feeling of powerlessness. Because in the old days, we're conditioned to be hardwired to be anxious, because you'd go outside your little hut or your cave or your house, and you'd see if there was any trouble, and there wouldn't be trouble, or there would be trouble, and then you'd deal with it if there was. Now we look, have that same instinct to look outside at the world and see if there's any trouble around, and there's lots of trouble around, but how much of that we're actually responsible for or can do anything about, not that much. So it leads to stress and a lot of internet squabbles.
And the way we communicate, of course, has changed dramatically, and children particularly don't hold conversations anymore. And I must confess, it winds me up dramatically as somebody who likes to talk rather than write things down. When, you know, you'll see somebody who'll send a text message to somebody, and then they'll misinterpret the response as, oh, they're angry with me now. And I'm, you'll say, well, pick up the phone. They're not angry with you at all. You've just misinterpreted it. Talk to them. And we've kind of lost that, haven't we?
Well, yeah, I feel like we're all kind of half in one world, half in another. So we'll be in the physical same room as someone. And I'm quite hypocritical here, because I'm the same. I like with my kids, one thing I feel guilty about as a father often is, even though I'm a stay-at-home dad, I'm often like detached, because I'm in my own little internet world, or I'm staring at the laptop, and, you know, no sort of face-to-face contact. But I have to say also, one reason to be optimistic about the generation coming up is the fact that, yes, they are the most digital, most connected, but they're also the ones, surveys are starting to show us, they're also the ones that are most in tune with it as a mental health issue, most understanding that they need to have digital detoxes and stuff. So I think there might be good things. When this generation grows up, they'll actually be trying to address, because I think my generation, I'm in my 40s, I think my generation sort of willfully, blindly just accepted technology and just went for it. But now the problems are starting to emerge, and it's being seen as a bit more of a health issue as our understanding of mental health increases as well. I think the real sad thing for kids is the fact that, you know, I didn't always have a perfect time at school, and like, I had a couple of really bad, rough years at school. But at least you knew at 4 o'clock, that was it. That was your day over. You could have some space to just be on your own and be fine. Whereas now kids are expected, you know, it's their peer pressure expectation to just be online, be connected, be on Snapchat, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. And it's, yeah, that's not good. The fact that there's no space away from it.
Well, I'm delighted that there is optimism there, and both your books are well worth a read. Reasons to Stay Alive, and this new one called Notes on a Nervous Planet. Both great reads. It's been lovely to talk to you today, Matt. Really appreciate your time. Thank you very much indeed, sir.
Thanks, mate. Cheers.
You take care. Bye-bye.